Greetings, kindred witches. Welcome to this episode of Atomic Witchcraft.
Here, we share our experiences as we build a modern-day inclusive witchcraft practice rooted in nature seasons, celestial cycles, and the science of energy.
Join us as we build a craft that learns from our past, is rooted in our present, and works toward building a better future, all while connecting deeply to the earth and sky around us.
Let us begin a new era of witchcraft. Hi everyone, I'm Ash, an atomic witch walking an eclectic road since the 90s.
I'm Alyssa, about 20 years in and growing a mostly green path.
And I'm Jay, new to the practice, composing a bard witch's craft. Because witch weaves together many webs, past, present, and future, we'd like to acknowledge that we are currently practicing our craft on the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, specifically the Duwamish, Muckleshoot, and Puyallup tribes.
The Atomic team participates in Real Rent, and we encourage you to engage with and contribute to similar programs in your area.
Welcome to our grove, here at the Atomic Hearth. Now, let's get witchy.
Welcome back to the Atomic Hearth. As we approach the new moon, I am jumping into my third topic of the year, the study of mosses and mushrooms. Now, I am a green witch, but I have never mindfully incorporated or interacted with these in either my practice or just as a witch showing up in the world. This is going to be a very top-level exploration, since I'm fairly certain I can spend a year learning all I can about either mosses or mushrooms alone, much less both. So I'm going to be keeping it kind of light. Like last time, we will be featuring our usual segments as well, including Charting the Celestial, which features yet another meteor shower, and the constellations Orion and Tucana. Our quarterly subject, which will be book club this time. Here, Jay, Ash, and myself will give a little summary, review, takeaway from each of the books we have been reading. And finally, Resistance Radio, to bring you methods mundane and magical to connect your craft into community and activism. Today, we'll be discussing how to recognize red flags for turfism, white supremacy, fascism, and more that you may come across in pagan and witchcraft communities. So let's lift off into the cosmos with our first section, Charting the Celestial. Eyes on the sky. What's in the sky for this coming new moon to new moon cycle? Did someone say meteor shower? Yes, folks, we have another one. November 16th to the 18th will be the peak of the Leonids. This shower's parent comet is 55P, or Temple Tuttle. That's some nice alliteration there. And the radiant point is the constellation Leo, specifically the region where the lion's mane would be. The peak is during a crescent moon, so light from the moon shouldn't affect the viewing. The best time to see the Leonids is right before dawn, so set that early alarm if you want to catch this show. We can expect about 15 meteors per hour, and they shoot across the sky rather scattershot, so heading outside and just looking up should suffice. A cool thing I learned while reading about the Leonids is that they have produced some of the biggest meteor storms in history. In 1833, witnesses reported around 100,000 meteors per hour cascading through the night sky. Meteor storm cycles have followed a roughly 33-year cycle for the Leonids, but nothing was quite as dramatic as the 1833 one until 1966, when people reported seeing 40 to 50 meteors per second in the early pre-dawn. For about 15 minutes that year, it felt like these meteors were falling like rain. Maybe one day soon we'll be so lucky to have a storm like this again. As the season continues to shift in the northern region, our axis tilts away from the sun, we begin to see Orion once again. Orion, aka the Hunter, is one of the best recognized patterns in the night sky, containing the notable asterism Orion's Belt and the Orion Nebula, which can be seen by the naked eye. This constellation is shaped very much like what it represents. Three bright stars make up the belt, three more, including the nebula, make up a sword that hangs from it. Further down, we have two stars that make up the feet. Then back up at the top, we have several stars that make up a head, a left arm holding a shield, and a right one wielding a club. Since Orion lies along the celestial equator, up here in the northern hemisphere, we see him in the south-southwestern skies. On a clear, dark night, bundle up and head out to look in that direction. Since Orion is quite large and bright, some urban lights, moonlight, and trees won't disrupt your viewing. In fact, our house is surrounded by trees, and I am able to spot him really well. The easiest way to make out this constellation is by first finding the Belt Asterism. While facing south-southwest, look for a straight line of three bright stars that have three slightly less bright stars hanging below. That's the belt that sits around the middle of Orion. From there, you can follow the sword down to his feet, then back up to the two bright stars that would make up the shoulder. These are the easiest stars to spot in any light-polluted condition. In darker conditions, you can make out the club and the shield as well, and see some fuzzy wisps of the nebula. For the southern hemisphere, I thought it'd be fun to talk about a more modern constellation. And by modern, I mean one that was first recorded in the 1500s rather than in the ancient world. This constellation is Toucana, or the Toucan. This is a circumpolar constellation, so it can only be seen in the southern hemisphere. It is viewable at all times of the year, but now is when this tropical bird tends to sit a little bit higher in the sky. To spot our feathered friend, face south on a dark, clear night. This is a fainter constellation, so as little light as possible is ideal. We are going to use the small Magellanic Cloud from episode 152 to find Toucana because, conveniently, it's right next door. Using the methods from our previous episode to find the cloud, look diagonal from it a little bit more to the south. There are six stars that make up the Toucan. Some outline them in a wonky triangle shape, and others into a body with a long, crooked beak. The latter shape personally makes much more sense to me. This is one of those constellations I recommend having a star chart or app ready to help you find it. Toucana may not be the brightest or grandest constellation I have spoken about, but with all the mythical creatures and heroes that litter our night sky, it tickles me a little that a simple toucan sits among the stars. Just because there isn't an epic poem attached to them doesn't mean that their presence is any less valuable.
Three stars along, and a belt comes to mind. But what else have minds made of these stars, besides the girdle upon Orion's frame? Where the Greeks saw a giant of strength and brawn, another culture found wisdom, foresight, and the weaving of destiny. From old Scandinavian tales, Norse mythology sees the spinning wheel of a powerful goddess, Frigg, queen to all Norse deities. Associated with marriage, prophecy, and motherhood, and known for dwelling in the halls of Fensalir, a watery bog realm of power, she married the god Odin and had several divine sons. Into the story of this goddess queen and her family, we dive now, for a tale of divine power, malicious trickery, and Frigg's enduring love for her son Baldur. It was a particularly cold night when Baldur and Frigg had the same nightmare. In the dream, Baldur was struck by a distant attacker. The pain was sharp and quick, and there was a feeling of betrayal to the scene. Knowing this was no ordinary bad dream, Baldur's father, Odin, knew of a particular oracle who could interpret this properly. The only catch? Well, at the time, she was quite dead. Undeterred by this particular fact, Odin mounted his mighty eight-legged horse Sleipnir and raced away to the realm of the dead. The oracle was upset at first by this rude awakening and refused, flat out. But Odin pleaded until she finally gave in. This was his son, after all. Unfortunately, all their fears were confirmed. Baldur would indeed die in the very way the dream had described. Frigg was determined to defy this prophecy. She knew she had command of all the creations of the world, and so she promised her son, "I shall have the whole of creation take an oath to your safety. Fire and water will spare you. No iron or metal, no stone or wood, not sickness, beast, bird, nor serpent's sting shall claim you. No manner of your fall shall remain, my dear son. You shall be invulnerable." Baldur embraced her and wept joyful tears, which shined, as he was always radiant and beautiful, and now would be invincible too, thanks to her. Oh, but all of this was far too sweet an ending for the impish trickster god Loki. He had always found Baldur's widespread beauty and fame to be tacky, at best. He took it on himself to find a loophole to the oath, and in disguise, he eventually got Frigg to admit to it. For she conceded that she had spared one humble sprig of mistletoe from the oath. It was just so young and small, so she let it be. Did it make it make an oath? Loki was thrilled with this discovery, so he located the sprig, fixed it to a spearhead, and rushed to where he knew the gods were already making sport of Baldur's new unharmable state with a game of target practice. He whispered quietly as he approached, "They make the whole world swear peace, but then play war. This mist mistletoe be the missile of Baldur's undoing." Still disguised, Loki handed the spear to the blind god Hodur, meaning slayer, and egged him on to see if he could strike Baldur true. And as Hodur did, the crowd gasped. An impossibly fatal wound had ended their game. Frigg ran to Baldur as his eyes drew closed. Tears of silver fell silently from her cheeks. She did not need to speak the request in her heart. Hermod, Baldur's brother, immediately rode with divine speed to the realm of the dead. There, in those halls of shadow, he found Baldur right away, but also the goddess of death, Hel. Hermod begged her for the grandest of exceptions, and in this begging, she designed her conditions. She would release him to life once again, on the condition that all things weep for Baldur. And so the call went out, with Frigg, Odin, and Hermod and their messengers spreading the call to mourn throughout the world. And soon all humanity, all animals, trees and plants, even inanimate objects, wept for Baldur. All except an old giantess named Thuk, in a remote cave, who simply refused and said, "Living or dead, I loved not that shining man. Let Hel hold to that she hath." She laughed the divine messengers out of the cave, and nothing could convince her. Baldur was forever condemned, which filled the giantess with delight, as her disguise faded away to reveal Loki's victorious smile. At long last, the prophecy had been fulfilled. So when you look upon these shining spots laid out upon the dark above, may this story offer wisdom that even the gods must sometimes yield to the way of fate, and offer comfort in this tale of a whole creation united in tears. Frigg may not have gained back her son, but saw all great and small join her call for a chance, just a chance, a hope, a wish, shared for one. And so these stories are told, drawn from the crisscrossing arcs and swirls above our magical minds. The cosmic cornucopia calls us to lie back, look up, and let our minds wander and wonder. As cultures around the world map their skies in a wonderful diversity of stories and interpretations, we encourage you to learn about the stories in your culture and the ancestors of the land on which you reside.
We began this season, season 5, with each of us taking on 5 topics, one for each quarter, which we share and have become the focus of our new moon brews and full moon focuses.
while our fifth topics have been woven in a bit more subtly, with astronomy, activism, and our creative creation. So while we've had our eyes to the skies, Alyssa has been taking on her fifth topic from a 101 approach, learning to literally map the skies. And while Jay and I each have our own fifth topics, we thought we'd come along for the ride, each adding our layer to the experience. Jay takes it from recognizing shapes in the skies to telling the stories that inspire us. And then as that evolves, I share how an astronomy practice has a place in witchcraft through the magic and wisdom in the molecule. We are now about 3/4 of the way through season 5, and I thought I might offer up my time for this segment for a chance to check in, to share our goals and progress along this journey. So first, I suppose we should answer, why astronomy as a path? Well, astrology and witchcraft are often common bedfellows, and while astrology offers us yet another framework from which to approach things, we wanted to shift into a more scientific approach, and astronomy allows us the chance to connect with stars through visual connection, storytelling, and wisdom. So Alyssa, when you began, I know part of this goal was to get a better sense of the skies. How are you feeling with that? What's the biggest concept that you've learned so far?
I mean, honestly, between my section on events, Jay's section on stories, and your portion on, like, the sciences in it all, I've gotten more out of this year in astronomy so far than I ever hoped to.
Did you know we had as many meteor showers as we did?
I did not. So my goodness.
Many.
And honestly, the way I've been approaching how to find the objects in the night sky, using north or south points in the sky to navigate, or jumping off of constellations to get to others, has helped me be able to find and recognize said objects easier than before, which was a big goal of mine. I've also had the privilege to learn about amazing celestial sights in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, I really...
Us too. That's been great.
Yeah, right? I wouldn't have had a reason to do so without this segment.
You wouldn't get to see them.
That's sure, for sure. Not unless you go to New Zealand. But going into it, I knew that there were obviously some different constellations, but I didn't expect to find things like the Jewel Box Cluster, the Coal Sack Dark Nebula, yeah, and the Magellanic Clouds, which I didn't realize we had satellite galaxies so close, quote unquote, to our own. It's just been a great year of gaining all of this knowledge about a subject I find really highly fascinating. And also, diving into astronomy throughout my wheel year has reminded me how much I loved it as a kid. I remembered that I had this big blue notebook that I used to write about astronomical happenings and make drawings about my observations and write about the science behind an event that I would do research on. I would stay out late or wake up really early to experience eclipses, conjunctions. I would break out my telescope and try to catch Saturn's rings. I would watch every astronomy show on the Science Channel, like a real proper nerd here. But I had kind of forgotten about all that. And doing this focus for the year really reminded me of something special.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how working with the stars also brings me back to childhood, those times with the telescopes. And, you know, I think even as adults, we continue to learn more in the deeper layers. And yeah, maybe you'll make your next level blue notebook.
Ooh, that'd be so good.
Jay, this journey for you has been much more about learning stories as it has been about performing them. So what are your takeaways from this topic?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever appreciated so much the meaning of our constellations. Like, I knew they represented a number of characters and different characters depending on the culture, and I knew that there were stories tied to them, but, like, what I mean by meaning is what they've meant to us. Like, as a species, what constellations have meant to us.
Yeah.
In school, we learn the basics, right? How to find the common constellations. Sometimes that ties into the myths and stories that we've connected to them. But it wasn't until I found myself learning and sharing all these stories that I realized how much we've needed them. Like, these stories have provided emotional comfort, hope, endless entertainment. They're the original silver screen, the pictures always in motion above our heads, filled with action, intrigue, romance, comedy. They've given us this backdrop against which to make sense of some very challenging and cosmic questions, like, what is the depth of a divine mother's love? Or the true extent of a fool's hubris? Or why does day follow night? And how and why does it change from season to season? It allowed us, like, while science and discovery have certainly filled in the how, with less Olympians and more elliptical orbits. The beauty of these stories was that they could double their emotional power with helping us lowly little humans figure out how to plan our farming, how to celebrate birthdays on time.
Yep.
So, yeah, I'm hooked now. Like, I really, this had not been like a pastime of mine, and now I like can't help it. And I don't expect my interest in this to be quenched anytime soon. So, like, from a practice standpoint, it's encouraged me even more to welcome the power of myth and story in my craft, mm-hmm. both as an audience and performer. I never realized that Astro and Bardwich were so closely linked.
Now, Ash, for your science-loving heart, I have to imagine this year has been just such a fun, amazing ride of digging into space science.
Yeah.
Now I'm curious. Given as above, so below, what has exploring the ways of the cosmos taught you about the world here below? Or has it inspired to learn more about down here on our own fine planet?
Well, at a higher level, astronomy offers us insights into the patterns of our world. It can offer a sense of cadence and rhythm. And instead of pacing the world just by the seasons, we can also pace it by the night sky. When we talk about magic in the molecules and as above, so below, the goal is to weave together how those observations can be reflections into ourselves as humans and as witches. Just like nature, the cosmos offers us insight not just via science, but via intuition and connection. There's also something to be said about celestial rituals, whether around the moon or a particular planet, constellation, or meteor shower. These moments connect us both backward and forward in time, just like story. And cast is a much wider net than just the patterns of your local weather seasons, yeah. right? These are the stories we tell. So in a way, the cosmos connect us in a bigger web,
yeah.
regardless of how the planet's going to change. Now, that's not to say the cosmos don't change over time. They do, right? Yes, they do.
It's not a static state.
But it is a slower shift. And something that is kind of a little bit more universal. We can talk about Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere and not just, well, here in this specific area, this is what the weather is like that makes it this season, right? Because living in Arizona versus living in California versus living in the Pacific Northwest, very different vibes here. So, you know, traditionally witchcraft and astrology are common bedfellows, and there are definitely different veins of astrology, some that account more for that weeble wobble and the scientific change in the cosmos than others. But for instance, our astrological signs actually shift over time, right? Mm-hmm. And understanding that is where the astronomy actually comes in. So you can actually use astronomy to heighten your astrological practices by making it slightly more accurate, right?
Love that.
Also, you want to talk about your houses and the planets and understanding how to spot them, their stories and the molecules and their makeups. That can change how we connect with them, right? So, like, if you want to talk about, like, hey, my second house has Jupiter, well, let's talk about what is the science in the molecules of Jupiter? Yeah. What does that kind of inspire in you?
Pretty unique planet.
It is. And it has a storm. So what yes. does that say about that? Like, you know, let that inform how we interpret things versus, like, well, somebody once said that Jupiter is the planet of this.
Such and such, yeah.
Yeah, and then somebody's going to be like, well, but it's the planet of this. And I'm like, how about we look at the science? Like, what's the planet made of? What do yeah. we know that those
meshing those two together,
those chemical truly, things. So yeah. that, I think that allows us to kind of like weave in astrology as science-based witches in a way that maybe we wouldn't do if we just left it as its own practice, mm-hmm. right? It's approaching it through that lens of astronomy. But first you have to be able to like spot those things in the night sky, being able to tell stories and understand that history that comes with them, and then finding that wisdom to kind of bring it down. So we, of course, will be continuing our celestial segments through the end of season 5. But we wanted to check in here and talk about the process, goals, and how you can weave this into your practice. So eyes to the skies, witches.
Mosses and mushrooms. Two inhabitants are a natural world that I always take delight in. But honestly, just have really surface knowledge of and haven't explored in my craft beyond just keeping some dried bits of each on my altar and stopping to appreciate both on forest strolls. This exploration for me is going to be very 101 centric. My goal here isn't necessarily to come away from these little revolutions with a spell or ritual the way I did with flowers and smoke. Rather, I hope to add more knowledge to my appreciation, get some hands-on interaction, and deepen my relationship to mosses and mushrooms in my green path practice. Believe it or not, I actually started off with a meditation this time.
Oh my gosh.
Really?
Yes.
I'm really excited about this.
Thank you. I went into my astral space, which usually opens to a big tree by a small creek. I chose to focus in on the base of the tree and the immediate creekside, which I often casually note has moss on it, but this time I really honed in on the details. I took note of the shades of green and different textures. I spotted small mushrooms nestled in the nooks of the roots. I laid my hands on the earth and connected to that intricate web of mycelium that lay beneath. And I just kind of stayed like this, focusing on the small and unseen details of this environment until my timer went off and I was kind of snapped back out of it. After my meditation, I sat down with a journal from Jay that he got me because it has lots of cool photography of mushrooms and mosses throughout, and began to note what I already knew about my subjects. I wrote that both thrived in similar environments, which are forests that are moist and have lots of nutrients in the soil. Here in the Pacific Northwest, there is no shortage of these environments. Both are good indicators of environmental health. Mosses will only grow on trees in areas that have good air quality. Mushrooms do really well in rich loams where there is a healthy decay. The mycelium that lives beneath the surface needs robust nutrients in order to fruit into the fungi, which are the mushrooms. Speaking of decay, both for me are good way markers in the life-death cycle that is present in a green path. Mushrooms help in the process of breaking down dead matter, aiding that final portion of the cycle. Moss thrives off of the nutrients that leach off of decay, thus bringing about the beginning of the cycle once again. Each of them have their relationships to people, too. For mushrooms, they can be used in culinary, medicinal, and recreational applications. Mosses have less of an obvious relationship, but we see it in peat moss being used in gardening and historically having been used by indigenous cultures in a variety of applications from lining shoes for warmth to menstrual products. Now, as I'm diving in, and I know the two of yours practices, and I know that neither of you have really tossed on mushrooms, not mosses, whatever. So I have a query for our grove. When you're approaching something that you've never connected with before, and we don't have a big internal community source, where do you turn to, and how do you get started? How do you like to approach it?
You mean other than listening to episodes of this very podcast? Because that's all I got.
No, that's a non-starter here.
Seriously, though, it can be a challenging point. I begin predominantly, personally, with the non-witchy sources first. Even if I do know y'all might have wisdom to lend on the witchy front, first, via just some Googling and then maybe expanding to the library or bookstore, I want to get to know the subject I have in mind from sort of like an objective point of view. Mm-hmm. So let me give you an example. Sigils, right? Even if our community knows some things, and maybe if I know of some good books, sometimes what I will do, but especially if I know you don't have knowledge and I know we don't have good books, that's just not true. I'd start researching symbolism and imagery.
Okay.
In general, the meaning of it, the power of it, the cultures around it, its history, its related science and research. Basically, I want to get to know this topic kind of all on its own and just think for myself a bit about its witchy significance to me. How does this connect with my sense of how energy works in the world? What elements or lunar phases does it connect with? Anything like that. And then I'd use this as a background when turning to witchy sources because they're unfamiliar to me. Not necessarily to find the same info. I'm not going to. But I want to start this way where I did already get a kind of sense of which sources get it for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like if one source is talking about how sigils drawn in a certain shape literally open the doors of the universe, and another explains how their magic comes from the correlations and correspondences we draw to the shared meaning we have as humans of certain symbolism.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll stick with the latter.
Yeah, yeah.
Personally, as it's in line with sort of what I found first and how I approach my practice.
Much like you, Jay, and Alyssa, you know, I like to start a bit more practical. I'm a list human, so I do literally start, like Alyssa, with a kind of a list of what I already know or what I think I know. I think that's a really great place to start.
Yeah.
And then I put on, like, my child, inner child situation and let curiosity kind of reign. And I just start asking myself those questions, like, but why? but how?
But how come?
Yeah. But yeah. And then, well, like, it just kind of starts to lead into that science stuff, whether it's the psychology science or the chemistry or the physics or the astronomy. And I start to try to answer those questions through those lenses. And we do live in the age of the internet. But like Jay, I'm going to advocate for the local library as well. Even Absolutely. If you start with something that's a little slightly outdated,
yeah.
it can give you a sense of things. And it can often lead to the path of asking the right questions to get the right answers or the answers you're looking for. But science isn't just research, it's also observation. So this is where when I say like how do you learn a lot, I learn a lot from nature and the celestial through observation. Watching. Right, like that's actually one of the big things here. I like to observe things in the wild. I like to observe even through things like documentary movies where you are kind of still like that third person observation, but it's a good way to observe things that maybe we don't see in our day-to-day lives or, you know, what we don't hear about. Like, I know there's some really amazing documentaries out there about moss and mushroom, and they, it shows you some things like mushrooms you're never going to see in real life or things like that, that may be a little bit more, just like kind of outside of your every day-to-day sphere. And then, of course, another way to approach things is through story. What stories do we tell here as a culture and historically? In the case of moss and mushrooms, I often think about how moss is often like the beds for magical creatures in stories or holds healing properties. Sure,
And mushrooms are like little houses.
Yeah, and mushrooms or even fungi offer us not just what we see above, but that vast network mm-hmm. of support and communications underneath it. And like, they were here long before us and will continue long after us, along with like stuff like algae. And so this is like maybe the closest to an eternal life form that we'll ever really get to experience.
Yeah.
And then like you started with, I'm so proud. I would do an astral meditation, right? I plant that item in my sphere and see what comes up, you know, and I would even go so far as, instead of just kind of being open to what's already existing, actually going ahead and planting that seed in the space and encouraging it to grow a little bit of the mm-hmm. fern gully, put the seed in the palm.
Let it grow, Krista.
Make it grow, right? Like, yes, you can observe what's already there, but in this case, because you actually want to plant that seed inside of you, like, what does that mean to you and what does it mean to tend and care? If you plant that seed, what kind of mushroom grows for you? You know, and what does that tell you? How is that mushroom applied? You know, like, what are its scientific properties? What it's, you know, how do we use it? And so I think that, again, that ties that back. And of course, there's always that community. If it just often means finding the right place to look, and it does involve a bit of source and vibe checking your finds, right? Like you did, Jay, that's like a perfect example. And sometimes a resource can start off sounding aligned with your interest, but then you find like there's a conflict in values. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later in this episode, actually.
Yeah, I didn't say it before, but like Carr's method, people, don't forget that Carr's
method. Oh, that's right. Carr's method. And ultimately though, I think for me, it's that cycle of reflect on what I know, research, observe, and maybe even participate. Think like science experiment type stuff, synthesize, make meaning, you know.
Yeah, well, like you both mentioned, starting off with that practical knowledge base is a really good place to start, and that is where I dive in. Throughout my first and some of my second lunar cycle, I really leaned into this research aspect. I rewatched the documentary Fantastic Fungi.
That's it!
It's so good!
It is so good.
I had seen some years ago, but I didn't really remember all of it, so I wanted to go back and rewatch it. It explores the incredible networks of mycelium, how they communicate mm-hmm. and help other forest dwellers, like trees, to communicate with each other.
Oh, it's so good.
How mushrooms, including psychedelics, can be used to treat medical conditions, and how, you know, looking to the future, how these amazing organisms can be used to clean up oil spills or even deconstruct and break down plastic. I super recommend this film, whether you're interested in incorporating mushrooms into your practice or not. It's just a really cool look at fungi, which we as people are still learning a lot about. I also started really poking into my mushroom ID book called All That the Rain Promises and More.
Oh, what a poetic book title.
It's lovely. It's so sweet. It's by David Aurora, and yes, that is the title of the book. And the subtitle is A Hip Pocket Guide to Western Mushrooms. the cover of image of this book is amazing, and I will post it. So the moment I saw it at the Nature Center in Moran State Park, like several years ago, I knew I had to get it. Silly title and subtitle aside, it's honestly a great guide to mushroom species here in the Western United States. It's chock full of color photos and really clear descriptions that make IDing mushrooms clear, safe, and really easy, honestly. But my favorite thing about this book is that dotted throughout are personal stories from people describing their favorite mushroom foraging moments or how they once saw a really cool and rare fungi.
Oh god, I love when nerds nerd out.
Oh god, it's so nerdy and it's so sweet and it's really lovely. But now that the rains are really moving back here into the Pacific Northwest and mushrooms are going to be fruiting again, I'm going to be bringing this book with me on forest walks so that I can know exactly what I'm looking at and maybe even do a little foraging. When it came to moss resources, I began diving into Robin Wall Kimmerer's first book, Gathering Moss, subtitled A Natural and Cultural History of Mosses. Kimmerer is a botanist and a member of the Potawatomi Nation, so she writes from a place of being a scientist and someone who's indigenous. I highly recommend all of her writings.
Second that.
Oh, they're so good. I mean, her book, other books, Braiding Sweetgrass and The Service Berry. Honestly, I recommend it to anyone following an earth-based witchcraft practice. It's a short book, but her material is always so dense, and I gain a lot of knowledge from it, which I'll talk about in a little bit more as it's my book club book too. I also watched this lovely documentary called The Magical World of Moss. You can find it on YouTube. It's from the BBC, which it's only about an hour long and it's great for an easy watch, but it's full of this beautiful imagery and examines the role mosses have played throughout history, from being the first likely terrestrial plant life to ever exist to its importance in cultures throughout the world. It definitely expanded my view on mosses from what I just saw here in the Pacific Northwest to how they're mindfully used and honored in carefully curated Japanese gardens and how they thrive in even harsh environments like volcanic fields in Iceland.
Wow.
It's honestly amazing and grow to a point that they can support additional life and create a really diverse bio landscape where there would have just been barren rock. I mean, mosses are truly incredible.
I really have fallen in love with the moss that's kind of like around. I have it growing on stone and stuff
it's
like that.
So
and
the good.
Trees. I,
yes, the moss on the trees just sings to my soul.
It's like little sweaters.
It is like little sweaters. But all of this research is really great. But as I tend to, I really want to get some hands-on experience. Going out into the woods and examining and appreciating the mosses and mushrooms I encounter is fine, but I really want to get my hands in a little bit more dirt. So I have a few ideas, like maybe growing wine-cap mushrooms in a portion of my yard, or like curating a garden portion dedicated to moss somehow, or maybe making a little mini terrarium, or trying to get into foraging mushrooms, which is something I'm like nervous-sighted about, you know?
Yeah, it's slightly dangerous.
It's slightly dangerous, or maybe even trying to apply mushrooms to medicinal purposes. I don't know. I have lots of ideas here. So for my next part, I want to pick something that feels attainable within the rest of the cycle and synthesize how I want to incorporate mosses and mushrooms into my practice. So any last words or ideas?
Wow, that feels really dark when we just talk about like the potential of mushroom
hunting. I said it backwards. Any ideas or last words of encouragement before I round out my lunar cycles?
Well, I mean, you talked about foraging and the potential risks, and I mean, immediately pops to mind is the fantastic and knowledgeable resource all over social media, Black Forager.
Oh yes,
who does highlight not
she
just
does.
Mushrooms.
I love the, her like game of like, will it kill me?
Is it deadly or a snack or something
yeah,
like
deadly
that?
Or a snack. Yeah, but truly, I mean, just one of a lot of actually great knowledgeable folks out there who are like, kind of out there in the wild having fun with it, and you can gain a lot of education from. But yeah, I mean, I'm just so delighted you chose this. I'm excited to inevitably be out in the woods with you because when you go to the woods, I tend to go to the woods. you're true. Already uncovering new magical worlds of knowledge. And I also love that you're taking time to appreciate something so locally rich, which in turn will deepen your just like everyday experience just living here in this part of the world. And that's,
yeah, for all of us here.
Maybe one other thought that's come to mind here is something you just made me think of now, which is like talking about, thinking about in this topic, kind of inspiring it, resilience, resourcefulness, and the adaptability of both mosses and mushrooms, right?
To be around as long as they have.
Look, I know this isn't resistance radio or anything. We'll get there shortly. But as this is a time when many things are uncertain and changing, it feels like this topic of some of nature's small but mighty, like, eternal persisters could not just offer up something enjoyable but truly inspiring and bolstering. The Bard Witch in me can't help but cheer for a little more inspiration and motivation these days, I guess.
Yeah, I'm also really looking forward to this journey. And I'm curious to see if and how you integrate this into your practice more holistically. I know as an earth witch, it's very likely. I think there's also a lot that these two topics have to teach in a way of a symbolic and even practical thing, things like connection and community.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've also been deeply fascinated on how both moss and mushrooms interact with their environments, especially trees. You know, Jay kind of finding out from the familiar journey, like ending that with like, well, now how do they all work together? Mm-hmm. And I think that these two things are two elements of the natural world that very much work in tandem with their surroundings. Absolutely. And so I'm excited to learn more about that.
I feel like nature's cousins.
And like Jay mentioned, these small but mighty resistors also have an unseen network and show up in community, a little bit of nature's lessons on display.
Each New Moon Brew, we feature a rotating slot with our exploration of Seasons of the Witch to our year-long dive into exploring witchcraft through a creative lens. Today, we'll feature our third rotating topic, book club. Here, we are focusing on books related to our craft, bringing you insights, summaries, and the most important verdict, to read or not to read, at least in our humble opinions. This fall, we each took on a different title with the hopes of bringing you a variety of ways you might want to engage. Please note that we are not paid to read or respond to these books in any way, hashtag not sponsored. We simply select based on what works best for our practices. Now, as I teased previously, my book club book was Gathering Moss by Robin Wall Kimmerer. To pull a quote from the book description, Robin Wall Kimmerer's book is not an identification guide, nor is it a scientific treatise. Rather, it is a series of linked personal essays that will lead general readers and scientists alike to an understanding of how mosses live and how their lives are intertwined with the lives of countless other beings, from salmon and hummingbird to redwoods. Kimmerer clearly and artfully explains the biology of mosses, while at the same time reflecting on what these fascinating organisms have to teach us. And honestly, this really sums up the bulk of this book. It's about 162 pages long, so a fairly quick read, at least for me, and is easy to read in chunks as each essay stands alone as its own section within the book. This makes the book really easy to put down and then pick back up without feeling lost, since you don't need to fully remember the previous essays to enjoy the rest. Heck, you could just pick an essay at random and read it. Kimmerer's writings stem from her own experiences with moss, both as a botanist studying bryophyte ecology and as an indigenous woman who has a deep relationship with the land and how everything is interconnected. I honestly learned so much from reading this book, and I will probably go back and reread certain essays throughout the rest of my current lunar cycles. She explores so many aspects of moss, from how certain species reproduce and spread to the ways that moss wait and conserve energy during dry seasons and how quickly they bounce back with the rain.
That explains so much.
It explains so much. And to how they're basically microforests and just how many species they can house and support, their relationships with humans past and present and looking to the future. There's a lot in here. She ties a lot of her scientific knowledge and observations to more philosophical ideologies, like this web of reciprocity, or how aspects of nature work together and support each other in a give and take relationship. And honestly, Kimmerer speaks a lot about this in her books. It's a running theme. To quote an example of this writing style, moss mats often serve as nurseries for infant trees. A seed falling on a bed of moss finds itself nestled safely among the leafy shoots, which can hold water longer than bare soil and give it a head start. Mossy logs are often referred to as nurse logs. The trees give thanks to mosses. It just kind of gives you a feeling of how she interweaves this writing style and this philosophy and this science.
It's amazing.
It's really beautiful.
And my biggest takeaway, I mean, honestly, I came away from this book with way more knowledge about mosses than I ever previously could have dreamed of and had. And I have a deeper appreciation for them and the part that they play in the environment. I learned that they inhabit nearly every ecosystem on Earth and number as many as 22,000 species. I also learned that because there are so many species and their differences are hard to determine and identify outside of a microscope, that most mosses don't have common names the way that flowers and trees do.
Aww.
I know, I feel a little bit sad.
They're just all moss.
They're all beautiful. They are such an intricate part of the natural world, and they give so much to their immediate environments. Kimura is always looking to how plants and animals might teach us, humans, about once again living in tandem with nature, living as an active member of the cycle of reciprocity, rather than an outsider who takes and takes until there's nothing left. She finds a lot of these beautiful lessons in the moss. And for me, it's simultaneously inspiring and disheartening. I find myself walking away from her books being like, wow, humans, specifically colonizers, suck.
Yeah, now, that's real.
I mean,
Not wrong.
And that's not in her intention. That's honestly just the cynic in me. Her messages are truly ones of hope. She ends a chapter where she discusses the terrible effects that practices like clear-cutting forests have on moss colonies and the ecosystem as a whole with this beautiful sentiment. The patterns of reciprocity, by which mosses bind together a forest community, offer us a vision of what could be. They take only the little that they need and give back in abundance. I hold tight to the vision that someday soon we will find the courage of self-restraint, the humility to live like mosses. On that day, when we rise and give thanks to the forest, may we hear the echo in return, the forest giving thanks to the people. And now we're all here crying because it's a beautiful line and a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
But I absolutely recommend this book. I honestly recommend all of Kimura's book, but this one is a great place to start. I recommend it whether you're on a green path or not. If you have an interest in botany and ecology, or just the vaguest curiosity about the moths that is living on your roof. The way she writes is really accessible. She never gets too heavy with scientific terminology. And the way Kimura frames everything is within stories, and it just makes it for a really pleasant reading experience. Go grab a copy from your local library or bookstore, and if you love it, introduce it to someone who you'll also find it interesting. All right, that's my book, as every one of us teary-eyed around the table. Jay, what about you? Yeah. Your biggest takeaway? Would you recommend it? What's your book about?
Really, tell us a little more. That you didn't set the bar too high here.
Yeah, not at all.
I loved my book. Just to spoil it right up front. I read How to Read Water by Tristan Gooley. And I've read Tristan's works before, but I was really excited to try out another one of them. I really enjoyed and utilized his Wild Signs and Star Paths on multiple occasions. And given the water-based nature of my current elixirs topic that I am in the middle of, just starting, his How to Read Water book seemed like the perfect place to start. This book, as he explains up front, is unique from many water books you may find, as you know, many of them stay solely focused on the inhabitants of water, the surroundings, the systems shaped by water. While he does cover those things, the focus is the water itself.
Ooh.
Not just the H2O, but reading water, truly. I wasn't honestly exactly sure what that would mean at first, to be honest, but I started learning more than I ever thought there was to know about puddles, ponds, lakes, rivers, waves, currents, ripples, tide patterns, lunar cycles. I was so fascinated, and there was so much to enjoy and discover, and it was so much that I'd always taken for granted when looking at or swimming in all manner of bodies of water. I especially appreciate how much he focuses on the real art and skill of reading water as a human skill set that has sort of blossomed around the world in different places, you know, namely calling out the innate skills that have been practiced since long before devices and tools we use today to navigate the world, to understand water around our planet through its mystifying arrays of patterns and signs. There's a particular beautiful anecdote he throws in for one whole chapter, which simply tells the story of a week he spent in Oman in the Middle East, navigating a sailing voyage for a hand-picked crew of skilled folks like himself, using purely the stars and water patterns from around the world. You know, very similar to Wild Signs and Star Paths, this book is designed to awaken these kind of innate skills we humans have within us, pattern recognition, natural instincts, to never see the smallest or most subtle wave or ripple or puddle on the sidewalk the same way again. With every new chapter, I've been greeted each time with patterns and scenes I've seen so many times before, but The way softer sand, for example, is always at the center point of a crescent beach, or the color of a shallow river versus the colors of the sea on an overcast day. The irregular variations in the path of sunlight reflecting off of a lake, and then calmly had it explained how these things actually work and had my mind blown time after time.
Times when the like science of it really just, again, makes it more magical.
It does make it, no witchiness in this book at all, to be clear. This is just naturalist observational stuff, and even just filled with these beautiful anecdotes that are really easy and relatable. So, you know, this is a guide to seeing water in ways you've never known, and yet things that we have used for millennia to gauge wind speed down to how many knots exactly, to know exactly when and where a fish will jump, to read hours of past events of the bay you're looking at just from looking at the shape of the waves and the color of the water, even to appreciate a nature artist's ability to capture the nuances of moonlight on a river.
Mm, wow. That's cool.
So I certainly recommend this book.
Of course you do.
One of my favorite things about this book is actually the way that he writes it. It's conversational, it's quirky, and accessible even in like in all the things that he covers, no matter how kind of amazing they are. You know, I still adore Wild Science and Star Paths, but it can be really dense at times.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot.
Kind of poetically esoteric in some areas.
Very much.
Which, like, for me, puts a little feeling of, like, expert distance between, like, the kind of pro Tristan is, like, renowned global, he's been on TV programs kind of a professional, and, like, the lonely noob I am looking out my back door. So by comparison in this book, he shifts that tone. He really leans into explaining in plain speech, re-referencing details shared earlier to kind of like help with retention and tie things together. And honestly, there's just a nice amount of jokes and relevant stories, including really poor decisions that he himself has made involving swimming, boating choices, what have you.
Water's dangerous.
Yeah. You know, and this all provides like a real balance and fun to it. So not only now do I know a ton of new things about water, but I've definitely gotten to know the author better as a person.
Well, I'm going to have to steal that from you and read it next.
Yeah. But, next.
Yep. It is your turn, Ash. What's your book? What's your biggest takeaway? And to read or not to read?
So I read The Power of Ritual by Caspar Turkile. And this was a really interesting read, mostly because it was a step off the beaten witchy path. It definitely approaches the topic of ritual from a more traditional religious perspective. So with that, I do want to give some content warnings for religious references and concepts. The author also does some big references to the book that shall not be named. Now, Casper is openly gay and admits the harm that is done by the author of the book that shall not be named, for, you know, giving it a name shall give it power, and in this case, money. So that content warning in hand, I actually thought there were some great takeaways. The book itself is a bit of an instruction manual, so my takeaways also give a bit of a rundown, enough that if you chose not to read it due to the content warnings, you could still have some good things to walk away with from what I share. Overall, Turkile wants to inspire us to find the ritual in the everyday, or through everyday things, create ritual. Turkile starts off by framing ritual through connection with four aspects: yourself, the people around you, nature, and transcendence. He goes on to say that ritual also has a lot to do with intention, attention, and repetition. So, intention, attention, and repetition. Now, here we get a bit of the content warning as he approaches the concept of taking a book or a section of text, could be a play or even a movie, and approaching it from the lens of process and analyzing bigger questions and themes. It actually kind of reminds me of the type of reading I did in school where we're prompted with bigger picture questions or, you know, what does this symbolize? What did the author mean about that? Now, this particular aspect is a little take it or leave it for me in the ritual aspect, but I do appreciate the idea of breaking down a text. I think it would really depend on the chosen text, onto whether or not I could really get into it. Turkile goes on to talk about Sabbath time based on the Jewish Shabbat, which is about taking soul time, and it could be any number of things, but some ideas might be taking a Sabbath where you disconnect from tech for an evening. It could be a Sabbath from other people, so you get a little personal time. Or maybe it's a play Sabbath and you actually focus on doing something that inspires a sense of play.
So finding little ways to tap into something important can add a sense of ritual. So far we've talked about ritual in the form of the self connecting through text, and, you know, maybe even connecting by disconnecting from other things. Then moving on to ritual through others, Turkile says that when we spend time with others, things like eating together is often a very common ritual or even sacred practice. Now, not sacred as in religious, but as in something special or dedicated. It holds a sense of weight and importance through how we honor it. Now, this hits a memory button for me of dinners growing up with my family, the times we ate together around the table, and the times I sat around friends' dinner tables in much the same way, learning their rules and traditions. It was always a special moment, and I loved getting that peek into the natural rituals of my friends' families. Turkile goes on to share that part of connecting with others is actually decentering ourselves, and through that we explore interconnection, something we often feel in big moments when we're with others in groups, like at concerts or raves, anytime we're all dancing, moving, singing together. Now, this doesn't come without warning, though. Turkile shares that, like, community is both wonderful and terrible, and definitely requires a bit of courage. From working with others, we move into nature, and this next one is perhaps my favorite of them all, which is the art of the pilgrimage, a bit of a ritualistic journey. Here, Turkile defines this by setting a purpose or intention. It can be broad, then there is sort of a journey of some sort. It can be simple, like a walk around the block, and then an arrival and return where there's an integration of what was experienced in our life. So set a purpose with intention, go on a journey of some sort, simple walk around the block, and then return, arrival and return, where you integrate that experience. So you maybe reflect on that journey. I think this has so much potential. In fact, we did a little, test run recently when we were celebrating Jay's bewitching, which is kind of like a witchy birthday for us. And so part of that was to send Jay out on a pilgrimage around the block to collect representations of the elements. When we send him out into the world, it was a little bit rough, but there was so much potential there. And what Jay came back with was pretty amazing. And I mean, only Jay can speak to that experience. But from a host of that experience, I will say it felt right to include that. Then Turkile gets into some connections with nature that are a bit more familiar with, like the seasonal celebrations, things we've been talking about there. And this includes redefining or even reclaiming some of the liturgical holidays. So much like we have in our own grove, you know, we have taken some things that were appropriated from other cultures and said, you know, hey, we're going to shift them and make these our own. We've also taken traditions that are often not related to a religious connotation, they're more secular, and included those in our celebration. So it's really about finding things that work for you here. And I think this is kind of that moment where you get to shape your practice in some really meaningful ways. And then, of course, Turkile goes on and recommends learning about and acknowledging the land in which we reside and create and do rituals. So that is another aspect. Now, this last section on transcendence really focuses on prayer, which at first I had big hesitations on, let me tell you. I walked in really thinking, you know, spells are prayers, and I have very much said those exact words, but I admit Turkile might have changed my mind here. He outlines different elements or types of prayer, from adoration to contrition to thanksgiving and supplication. And I realized in that outline that none of those were really about setting an intention or manifesting something into your life. Maybe spells are more like goal setting after all. Turkile did sell me a bit on prayer, though. Can't say I love the word. It does make me feel all kinds of ways, to say the least. But there are some concepts that were familiar. Things like adoration, as those moments when we feel connected to the bigger picture. Or contrition and shadow work seem to hold a similar tone. Giving thanks is also something we hold within the craft. And then there's also supplication, which Turkile described more as how we have compassionate awareness, much like how we hold space and light candles on altars for others. Overall, this was an interesting read, and I would recommend it for a witch who has been around the block a few times, especially with kind of deciphering out witchy intent from non-witchy readings. There aren't any direct connections here, right? This isn't a witchy book, but there is some great lessons to be had about ritual, so you can kind of have to weave and make your own takeaways. Overall, it was a pretty quick read, and I did walk away with some things I will be integrating into my own ritual formulas. So I would say it's a maybe read.
Resistance Radio, warrior witch tuning in to bring you ways mundane and magical to fight fascism, kick capitalism, protest patriarchy, and converge with community. All while we decolonize, deprogram, and fight for anti-racism, equal rights, and trans lives. And, of course, knowing when to rest and regroup, for that, in itself, is an act of rebellion. The past couple of episodes, we've talked about how one might find a role in resistance, but this lunar cycle, we wanted to tune in a little bit closer to home, and how some pagan and witchcraft communities offer direct pipelines to white supremacy, anti-trans, trad, and turf territories. These groups are often considered the quote-unquote natural homesteading branches of white and Christian nationalism, and wowza are things coming out of the woodwork. So today, we wanted to spend a good moment talking about how we might spot these groups and trends within our own communities, because it is up to us to kind of, you know, monitor our own little groves here. So, and this is also an opportunity to choose not to engage should you start seeing signs of any of these. Yeah. So let's start with the easy one. I don't know that any of these are really easy conversations, but look, the world is rough out there, especially for our trans community, our immigrant community, and hell, even as a non-Christian spiritual group. The weather is a brewing, and we have to be here to support each other. But what we can't be doing is spiritual bypassing this. We can't be out there saying that we can love and light our way through this. We have to be careful of hearing, don't be afraid, it will all be fine, mm-hmm. and not understanding that there is work to be done. Yes, we do have to find joy and sanity in this chaos, but it is not by gaslighting ourselves or our communities or other communities. It's about processing and working our way through it, not around yes. it, not over it, not spiritually bypassing it. And that is sure as hell not going to be easy, right? It's also not about the reverse of this either, right? It's not all doomsday and nihilism either. It's a damn balancing act some days, but that's okay. Let it be that. Don't let spirituality shine such a bright light that it blinds to the reality of what's happening. And I get that this is a large part of our witch's warrior value, right? But even without that, witchcraft isn't about some rosy-hued light. It's dirty, rough, bloody. It's life and death rolled into one. It sees the patterns of the web and which ones are worth fighting for.
It actually makes me think of two other pillars. Weavers, you're involved. You got to weave, yes. man. You got to take
your part. You are a part of this world.
And Guardians of the Grove. This is about actually being that presence, being aware, noticing and then not bypassing it, but working your way through it.
Yeah, the number of people I've seen in the spiritual community who are just like, oh, we just need to be the light workers right now, and we just need to hold this positive spiritual space and don't let yourself get drugged down. It's like, yes, we can't let ourselves lose hope and we can't let ourselves be brought down by this, but at the same time, like, we are a part of this world. We have to...
We should feel a little sad,
friends. We should feel a little sad. Yeah. We should feel empathy for our communities that are actively suffering right now. Being all love and light and woo-woo is not going to do anything for them. It's just going to make you feel better.
If they don't get to feel good these days, sorry, you shouldn't either.
And I know that's the misery loves company mentality, but yeah. it's also a little bit of the, like, all boats rise together, all boats sink yeah. together.
Yes. We all must rise together.
We are only as, you know, good as the person with the least amount in our society, right? And so kind of going back to that concept. And unfortunately, you know, our spiritual community isn't just gaslighting. There are other issues happening across the variety of occult forms, witchcraft, paganism. We're really starting to see this appear in this concept of pure witch bloodlines. It's a patriarchal and colonial approach to who has privilege and the right to do or practice something. And it's a bit of a covert op to keep some structures in place, right? To keep, yeah. It's a gatekeeping tool, right?
Yeah. Like this concept of the blood, witch bloodlines. Bloodlines.
And it's not the only, you know, time and place that we're seeing this creep up, but it is one of those things to kind of keep your eyes on as a little bit of a red flag. Now, I want to be clear, I'm going to make some statements and I'd love to give some benefit of the doubt to groups. So before I say anything, let's preface this with say that, like, these aren't all statements. These are some statements. So there are some groups that focus on very white supremacist practice. A common theme in this is a lot of North mythology and conquest. Now, often white supremacy can seem like it's very easy to spot, but
there's a little bit of dog whistle here. This is that subtle clues mm-hmm. that they give each other. It's this language they've developed over decades and decades of, well, hundreds of years, really, right? Of this thing like a one true race or a pure bloodline. And this mm-hmm. is where it gets tricky, because many of the Norse runes have been co-opted by white supremacist groups, making them possible flags, both to each other and to outsiders. So, you know, I recently was given a communication pamphlet at work with an extensive list, and lo and behold, chunks of the Norse runes and symbolisms were found within those pages, right? Yeah. So it's not a necessarily like this is for sure means that it's a white supremacist group, but it does mean that you should probably take a moment and do a little bit further digging, right? And this included less obvious things like shoe types with specific colored laces. And they've, you know, there's this whole secret, intricate language to signal their allegiance to hate. It helps them identify each other, but it also helps us identify mm-hmm. them.
Speaking of fascist corners of the interwebs, I'd like to cover something which has been on the rise, especially among young people, and that is Christian nationalism. Tying Christian faith to national identity has been around since, really, the Roman Empire. But while there have been certainly dips in global popularity, it's found new strength from the recent global political shift to the right. This is an important one we're covering, as while many witches may not interact with Christian communities or beliefs at all, as our topic today is what to be listening and looking out for, this one's a real dog whistle. Christian nationalist beliefs have persisted for hundreds of years because the actual language and influence are quite subtle, and that subtle language has only gotten more nuanced and widespread as our ability to communicate in big public spheres has grown like wildfire. Quick disclaimer, to be very clear, my topic here is not about Christians overall. Even now in my witchy life, I still look back very fondly on many positive experiences from my own Christian years and of the wonderful people I shared them with. I know that's not going to be true for all folks, but today I am only talking about the uniting of Christian faith with national pride and identity in a way that's frankly dangerous. As a former Christian, this is the kind of stuff I was regularly looking out for within my own communities. So first, the big theme lately: turn back the clock messages hooked into national pride. Make, insert this country, great, like it once was that one time 30, 50, 150 years ago, or some such. I'm sure this sounds familiar. This combination has taken numerous forms around the world, but all bundle Christian righteousness, social conservatism, and assertive national pride, and find strength in denouncing and casting out anything not meeting their specific combination of those three things. This big theme identified, there's really two big red flag kinds of ideas to call out here that are, they're worth looking out for two different reasons. First reason, so you can notice these red flags among the people you know and love. If it's a comfortable and safe relationship and space, catching this stuff early could be worth it. And even very well-meaning people can find themselves falling prey little by little, pushing them to agree with really extreme stuff over time without ever feeling the drift in that direction, and then feeling that the resulting belief isn't extreme at all. Second reason, knowing what to look out for is a safety matter for us witches nowadays. This varies more in some places than others, for sure. But here in America, we're entering an era when witchcraft may find itself directly in the path of our current administration, which is rife with Christian nationalist policies and attitudes. Okay, idea one, connecting Christian morality with national identity. Defining what's good and Christian requires an establishment of what's not normal, what's bad, e.g., we don't do that in our country. Suddenly, bad becomes un- or anti-Christian. The language here may start very light with words like weird or odd from talented pundits and politicians. It will often begin so subtle that it feels like just a gentle joke. But call something weird enough times, and it just means different or something parents need to watch out for, which leads me to idea two, that Christians are looking out for society because of the dangers inherent in ideas counter to what's Christian slash good. This playing the victim comes, consciously or otherwise, from a place of equating the persecution of Jesus to that of simply being disagreed with. It's their cross to bear, and suddenly a politician becomes a saint, and maybe one day a martyr. A big example today is the current U.S. government's push to rid transgender people of their rights, and you can hear it in their justifications. Whether it's bathroom policies or access to healthcare, protecting children sounds like a meaningful reason to anyone who's unfamiliar, but this is the just logical enough entry to pull them toward what ultimately are Christian nationalist aims. Now, while these attitudes aren't necessarily something you'll see too prevalent in witchy spaces and communities, it is literally everywhere else. In public policy, recent executive orders in America call out the defense against anti-Christian bias, and it's not a big stretch to see how witches, like ourselves, may be sorted into the anti-bucket there. And don't be surprised if you can catch these ideas in places like advertising or even mainstream entertainment. It's because of this ubiquity that it's worth listening and looking for, especially if you happen to live in a land that's Pledge of Allegiance still says one nation under God, indivisible. Each of these things alone isn't too bad, some of them good, but combine all three, and it all comes down to who's qualifying exactly what under God means.
One thing that is prevalent in witchy spaces that you also want to keep eyes and ears out for is turfism and similar mindsets in these communities. For those who don't know or whose first language may not be English, TERF stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. This is a person who engages in feministic ideals and beliefs, and let's be honest, it's usually just white feminism, but purposefully excludes trans people, especially trans women, from the conversation. In fact, these people often work against trans rights, including denying trans women access to women's spaces, like public restrooms. I've said this on here before, but I want to be really clear.
We want to be really clear.
We want to be really clear. Trans women are women. Trans men are men. Non-binary folks are valid and beautiful. And trans rights are human rights.
Preach.
If you don't like that or agree with it, you don't have to listen to this podcast.
Bye.
Unfortunately, TERFism has found its way into witchcraft, spiritual, pagan, and similar spaces that should be open and inclusive to the trans community. So if you, like us, want to avoid groups and places that are okay with TERF or similar attitudes, here are some things to keep an eye out for. For me, one of the clearer sides is when a group uses AFAB-coded language referring to women. AFAB stands for Assigned Female at Birth. An example of this type of coding I came across online was a pagan group holding a women's retreat, but they spelled woman, woman, like W-O-M-B-Y-N, a direct reference to the womb. This way of referring to women is exclusionary to trans women, or even just those without that body part. And sure enough, as I dug around, there was no writing on being open to included trans women in this group. You unfortunately come across this attitude quite a bit in, quote, women-only spaces, and rituals or classes or retreats that use divine feminine language. And yes, I am calling out, quote, divine feminine / divine goddess spaces, groups, covens here a bit, because they also tend to operate under this unnecessary gender binary belief. It's why in our grove, we avoid using gender terms. The moon is not a woman, fire is not masculine, they just are. Not sure if a group is inclusive or not? Ask. Send a message saying, hey, do you include trans and or non-binary folks? If the answer is no or wishy-washy and dodges the question, don't engage with them. And unfortunately, sometimes you'll come across a group that has inclusive seeming language like, quote, women and non-binary folks welcome, but they really only mean AFAB non-binary folks and won't include AMAB, assigned male at birth, or mask non-binary folks. We need to hold each other accountable in the craft because witchcraft is for everyone, not just the exclusively divine feminine or divine masculine.
Hear that.
You're here.
Now that we've talked about an exclusionary branch of feminism, which, to be honest, I don't even consider feminism in the first place, I want to go ahead and address the rise in the anti-feminist movement that we have seen, the traditional or trad movement. Yes, I never thought I'd see the day I talked about trad wives on our podcast, but these are dark times, my friends.
Dark, dark times.
The traditional, aka trad movement, is kind of what it sounds like. Going back to traditional values and lifestyles, this kind of ties back into the Christian nationalism we just touched on. This has been driven primarily by women, primarily by white cis women, and includes this belief that feminism was a, quote, mistake, and that we should return to women staying in the home to be mothers, only doing home-cooked meals, letting her husband control the finances, etc., etc. Now, some of these things are in a silo aren't, quote, bad, per se, if someone wants to choose that life, but the key word here is choose.
That was the whole point of the feminist movement, that was the friends. The whole point was that you got to choose. It wasn't that that was a bad choice. It's just that you got to choose.
So often these trad folks think that there shouldn't be a choice. That we should basically reverse decades, if not centuries, of fighting for women's equal rights. So we could go right back to being barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen.
I like being able to have a bank account.
Yes.
And vote.
Same.
Decisions like about my body, I mean, I'd like to have those back.
That'd be great.
I'm in total support, but I'm not speaking here because it's your turn.
Thank you, token white man. Now, you may be asking yourself, what does this have to do with witchcraft? Well, I have seen some small threads of this trad attitude begin to reach its little way toward the craft, usually through something else. The most common thread it begins to weave its way subtly in is via homesteading, gardening, and homemaking crafts. You see this often in social media. Someone posts videos about growing their own food, living with the land, raising chickens, how they like making home remedies, bake bread every day for their family, how their husband still goes to work while she's at home, etc. Now, this sounds fine on the surface, but they usually weave some tricky wording in if they aren't trying to be too obvious about being a trad wife. They'll say things like how they, quote, can't imagine a woman wanting a 9-to-5 when they can have this, or how they make their own cough syrup because they feel like they know best, or how they only ever cook from scratch since food in stores have, quote, so many ingredients and all processed food is just not wholesome. For someone like me, these statements raise flags. A belief that women shouldn't be a part of the workforce. A lack of trust in science. A lack of trust in certain food systems that just isn't sustainable. Things to just look out for, especially if you walk green or cottage paths and come across content like this. The trad slash anti-feminist movement is dangerous on multiple levels. Not only does it seek to undo women's rights, but often goes hand in hand with TERFism, anti-LGBTQIA2S+ ideology, anti-vaccine and anti-science rhetoric, anti-abortion opinions, Christian nationalism, and the cherry on top often includes an undertow of white supremacy.
And racism.
While I don't believe in gatekeeping, we should sure as hell keep this out of witchcraft. And that's our New Moon Brew on Moss and Mushrooms. Thank you so much for joining in. I'm hoping you'll return for our full moon focus episode coming up, where I'll round out this third subject.
In the meantime, you're always welcome to spend time in community with us in our monthly Sunday Havens and our Discord community server.
And join us on Patreon for the newsletter and behind-the-scenes podcast fun.
And until next time,
keep your world witchy.